You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
You're listening to Stick Together on 3CR Community Radio, bringing you stories from the world of union, social justice and collective action. I'm your host this week, James Brennan. Stick Together is Australia's national radio show dedicated to union and workplace justice, bringing you stories from the front line of the workers' movement. Every week, we bring you union news from around Australia, speak with workers, unionists, organisers, academics and activists from the issues affecting working people across the continent. Before we get started, we'd like to acknowledge traditional owners of the land from which we're broadcasting today. We acknowledge the people of the Kulin Nation, traditional owners of the lands on which 3CR broadcasts. We pay our respect to their elders past and present. We acknowledge that sovereignty was never ceded and recognise the continuing connection of First People to country. We also acknowledge the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander workers and unionists who have been fighting for justice, dignity, land and conditions, recognise the important role their Indigenous workers and communities have played in the history of the Australian labour movement. Stick Together is proudly supported by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Community broadcasting depends on listeners like you, volunteers and supporters to keep independent, community-controlled workers' stories on the air. Coming up today, we have our regular union news in just a moment. We'll be looking at some industrial issues from across Australia, but our main story today takes us to Western Australia's Pilbara region. We're going to be talking about the recent industrial action by BHP workers at Port Hedland and what it might mean for the future of unionism in one of Australia's most important mining regions. And we're going to be joined on the show by guest Alexis Vassily, unionist, socialist, academic and industrial relations researcher at Edith Cowan University and the author of Striking Ore, The Rise and Fall of Union Power in the Pilbara. Alexis was previously on Stick Together last year when Striking Ore was released. So today's conversation is a return to that chat that we had then. But this time we're looking at the current industrial action and lessons that we can learn from Alexis's book. But first, let's have a look at what's happening across the Australian union movement. Yeah, it's time for Union News, our weekly look at workers organising and taking industrial action across the country. And there's certainly no shortage of industrial disputes to talk about at the moment. We'll start in Victoria, where public hospital doctors represented by ASMOF Victoria are taking industrial action. Doctors at major hospitals across Melbourne are taking their first strike action in 20 years. The planned action follows negotiations for a new enterprise agreement that began back in August 2025, with the existing agreement expiring February this year. Around 76% of eligible members participated in the protected industrial action, and an almost 97% of those voted support industrial action. Victorian Transport Workers, the AMWU members of the Victorian Department of Transport and Planning, have also been taking industrial action. Workers are fighting proposed changes that will see them moved onto 24/7 rosters, lose 13 RDOs, and face reduction in public holiday rates. Allied health workers, represented by VAPA, have been escalating their campaign, with workers been bargaining with the Victorian government for almost a year. They've taken previous strike action and held workplace rallies, with further industrial actions being planned over the past couple of weeks. And it looks like Victorian public school teachers, the AAU, are going to vote yes to accept the EBA that they have been continuing industrial action now over a number of months. And it was workers within the union that pushed the union further to accept a better deal. In South Australia, more than 160 UWU members at Arnott's have taken 24-hour strike action, the first industrial action at the company since the 1990s. The University of Sydney in higher education, the NTU, members of the University of Sydney have begun industrial action as part of their enterprise bargaining campaign. They've organised a number of stop work meetings with an escalating campaign of actions. Pacific National, the RTBU members at Pacific National, have been taking industrial action in negotiations over their intermodal train crew agreement. Workers have imposed overtime bans and actions across the company's ability to change scheduled start times through lift up and lay back provisions. There's also been students walking out of their classroom to protest against Pauline Hanson, with further actions planned in the coming weeks, no doubt inspired by their teachers also taking industrial action to walk out of the classroom. And that's it for union news this week. And remember, if you have a story or action that you know about or you're involved in, please get in touch with us at sticktogether3cr@gmail.com. The Pilbara is one of the great industrial regions of Australia. It's one of the most important places in the Australian economy. The iron ore industry that developed there from the 1960s transformed the region and generated enormous wealth for mining companies. But the story of the Pilbara isn't just a story about mining companies and iron ore. It's a story about the workers and unions that built it. In the 1960s, as the iron ore industry expanded, working conditions could be extremely dangerous and management had enormous control over workers. But workers began organizing and the union organizations grew. By the 1970s, the Pilbara had developed one of the most militant union movements in Australia. Workers took strike action repeatedly and won major improvements in wages, safety, and conditions. Shop stewards and rank-and-file unionists developed significant power inside the workplaces there, and there were major strikes at places including Goldsworthy, Mount Newman, and Hammersley Iron. The Pilbara became synonymous with militant unionism. And as Alexis has written in his book Striking Ore, The Rise and Fall of Union Power, workers in the Pilbara were striking at extraordinary rate. At the height of union power, this is one of the most strike-prone sections of the Australian workforce. But from the 1980s onwards, employers launched increasingly aggressive attacks on union organization. The Robe River dispute of the 1986-87 was particularly important. It became a major confrontation over union power, with management attacking the role of shop stewards and seeking to change work practices unilaterally. The defeat of the unions at Robe River became a crucial moment of the destruction of union power at the Pilbara. Over the following decades, industry became increasingly de-unionized, and that history is subject of our guest book. Alexis' book looks back at how workers built union power and how that power transformed working life in the Pilbara. Importantly, Alexis's research puts workers themselves at the center of the story. Rank and file unionists, shop stewards and organizers who fought for improvements for pay, safety and conditions. And now, in 2026, something quite remarkable is happening. Workers at BHP's Port Hedland operations are taking industrial action. The dispute has been going on for months. The combined BHP Ports Union, including workers represented by the AWU, AMW and ETU, have been negotiating with BHP over a new enterprise agreement. Over 150 workers have been participating in industrial action, making this the first significant industrial action at the site in over 25 years. And Port Hedland is not just another workplace. The port handles enormous volumes of Australia's iron ore exports. Around $80 million worth of ore passes through the port every day. And Port Hedland handles the vast majority of Pilbara iron ore shipments. A relatively small number of strategically organised workers can potentially exercise enormous industrial power. Today, after decades of de-unionization, we're seeing workers organize across multiple unions and take strike action against one of the world's biggest mining companies. Alexis has himself described the current dispute as potentially significant for unionism in the region, asking whether workers can win a collective voice in an industry that's been largely de-unionized for decades in the region. Alexis is a unionist socialist academic at Edith Cowan University, specializing in industrial relations and labor history, and he's the author of Striking Ore, The Rise and Fall of Union Power in the Pilbara. If you're interested in hearing a little bit more about the historical context of this dispute, I'd recommend checking out Alexis's book.
Alexis, thanks so much for joining us on the show again. I think we spoke last year when your book Striking Ore came out, which kind of charts the rise and fall of union power in the Pilbara. And pretty exciting that we're chatting again, because there's some kind of pretty significant industrial action around the region. Maybe if you could just tell us a little bit about the kind of action that's happening there and why it's really significant, in the area.
Yeah, thanks, James. It's really exciting. And when I wrote my book, I sort of wrote it as a case study of relevance kind of more broadly than the Pilbara itself. And I actually, wasn't expecting a return of unionism more union strength so soon. So it's been, really a wonderful surprise. It's basically centered on the workers at BHP at the ports. It's actually two ports in Port Hedland. And they're negotiating an enterprise agreement with BHP. We've seen just over the weekend, actually, there was effectively 48 hours of industrial action at the ports of protected industrial action. And sometime before that, maybe 10 days or 2 weeks before that, was an 8 hour stoppage. Just in terms of the significance, the 8 hour stoppage was the first protected industrial action in the Pilbara iron ore industry since 2008, when Rio Tinto train drivers took some strike action, and it was the first at BHP since January 2000. So you're kind of looking at decades and decades without industrial action, and outside sections of train drivers, really decades and decades without a collective voice.
And I think, can you tell maybe, yeah, tell us a little bit about the kind of like the type of workers and the unions that are involved in the action. And I know through your book, you kind of talk about, what was a real centralized industrial power in the region. It must be pretty exciting to kind of see some of that come back from having spent so much time researching the region and the workers involved there to kind of see some of that information from the book come back to life again. Yeah, just tell us a little bit about, I guess, the kind of like what type of workers are involved in the action, what unions, I guess, are covering them. Is it, I guess, if it's yeah, I think it's pretty wide range of workers involved, so it must be a big EBA that they're trying to get across.
Yeah, that's right. It's basically all operational workers that work for BHP in BHP ports. So it's something like, so effectively they demonstrated majority support, and that's what forced BHP to bargain. So there's something like 450 workers who would be like under the scope, it would be represented by the enterprise agreement. And around, I think it's about 250 of them are in one of the unions. So it's three unions. There's the Electrical Trades Union, the ETU, and they've got most of the unionized workers. There's the Australian Workers Union, which is kind of working through the Western Mine Workers Alliance. But they cover the ship loaders, which interestingly is quite a sort of specialized position. And then there is also the AMWU. So it's those three unions, and that's basically who it is. And that they've sort of they're kind of spruiking themselves as the combined ports union, so they're negotiating together. It is pretty much the electrical trades union that is leading the charge on this one, and they've put quite a lot of resources into the Pilbara campaign fairly recently. And what's exciting as well is that with the strike action, there's been kind of more workers joining the union, and there's also some delegates as well. So yeah.
Is there anything that you like have seen or kind of heard that's kind of laid the ground for this industrial action to kind of take place in this negotiation? I imagine from the time like you were saying it's been such a long time since there's been industrial action in the region. There must have been other EBAs that were kind of fought for and won during that time. Is it, yeah, political context or some really kind of bullshit delegates or something that's kind of pushed things over the edge this time?
It's a really interesting question. Effective the final industry, like a union wage for the last 2.5 3 decades, like basically agreements for union negotiated enterprise agreements. It's basically only Rio Tinto train drivers and BHP train drivers, and so everyone else, so just like heaps and heaps of mine sites and literally thousands of workers, they're on above award individual contracts. So while there's union members and Particularly since probably around 2015, 2014, 2015, when the Western Mine Workers Alliance came into being, there has been, something of a growth in union membership. But, the unions don't have significant influence because there's no enterprise agreements, So it's quite a crazy situation in a way to have, an industry of this size, one as well where unions were kind of powerful, and where there are some union members, but just there is just an absolute kind of opposition by the companies to negotiating with unions. They basically want a non-union kind of industrial relations framework where it's just company control. So what it means is you have two people side by side doing the exact same job being paid tens of thousands of dollars differently. It means that there's no guaranteed pay rise every year. You could get 0%, you could get 4%. There's bonuses, and that it's up to your supervisor, like what your bonus is. If they don't like you because you're a union delegate, you might not get a bonus. If you're the boss's mate from the footy team who, they've recruited, you might get a big bonus, as well as all the, the kind of plum jobs and the training and the career progression and stuff. That kind of environment, really breeds significant grievances. And so yeah, so for instance, I think these are the right figures, but if I remember correctly, the Electrical Trades Union secretary Adam Woodage said that there's two electricians doing the same job. One is getting paid 160 grand and another is getting paid 240 grand. So there's sort of combustible material there. There's also a sense that conditions and pay have really declined and stagnated since the height of the iron ore boom, around sort of 2015, around 10 years ago, that just kind of gradually the companies are removing conditions, wages are stagnating, and where once, I guess, maybe people would have put up with it, they're sort of they're not, and unions have definitely put some resourcing in as well, and there's sort of an appetite for it. One other thing, I mean, this is just maybe a bit of speculation, but at BHP Ports, it's about 80% of the workforce are residential, so they live in Port Hedland, and it's only about 20% that are fly in, fly out. You would imagine that makes it, just that bit easier to organize. They're still on crazy kind of shifts and rosters, like it's still 12-hour days and so forth. But there's people that, live in Port Hedland. They might have might have connections to Port Hedland, and they kind of they want to stay there, but yeah, like the wages, particularly the electricians have sort of campaigned on this. You can actually get more, like in Perth or in the southwest of WA, or there's a whole range of places where you can actually just get more money. So yeah, even they sort of go on about mining being really high paid, and when they do that, they never take into account the crazy hours that you're working and so forth. But it's actually, it's actually not as good as it's made out.
Yeah, and I guess, the lot of risk that the workers are taking on for the work they're doing as well, the kind of hazard pay and things like that. It sounds like the company has really gone out of its way to really individualize people to create that, or to remove that idea of collectivism and, kind of really what unionism is about. I guess, yeah, thinking about the amount of
Yeah,
research
absolutely.
and stuff that you did for your book and, looking at this area and then the kind of like the peak of that time of unionism and that, like you've sort of already explained the kind of, that kind of has dropped a lot over the past 20 years or so. What has it been like to kind of, see this kind of spark back into action? I know that, you've also been around like chatting to some of the unions and, chatting to people about kind of putting this into a historical context. Yeah, what does that experience been like of seeing your book to kind of come to life again.
Thanks, James. No, I mean it's been fantastic. Look, it's a high stakes game, you know, and as I've been saying, you know, to other kind of media outlets, you know, you would think that if the workers get a successful enterprise agreement, you know, and by that I mean a genuine one where you know the wages are you know are reasonable and kind of comparable to elsewhere in the state where there's not, you know, huge pay differentials between workers doing the same jobs, and shock horror, where the conditions of work in the enterprise agreement, not just in company policy, so that you have, certainty over your working conditions for the life of the agreement. You know, that's not something that the companies want. But if it happens at one place, like surely workers at other companies are going to want to do the same thing, other sites and other companies. And, you know, that's, you know, to date, I'm not sure exactly what happened on Tuesday. I know there was another sort of, you know, bargaining session. But to date, you know, the sides have been very far apart, you know, precisely because I think the company realizes the significance of this. So it's a high stakes game. And, you know, I think the history kind of weighs, you know, it weighs heavily on it. Like there's sort of you know, there's this narrative that, you know, the unions went too far, you know, the unions were too militant. You know, so you get that from kind of people, you know, within the union movement. I mean, my book, my argument was no, the unions didn't go too far. You know, that actually it was through strike action, it was through grassroots, you know, campaigning through grassroots unionism, that everything good that, you know, was won. And then of course you get the you know, particularly the right wing media talk about the 70s and 80s as the bad old days. Well, you know, hold on a minute, like surely today is the bad old days. The 70s and 80s, I mean, not to sort of romanticize it and weren't perfect, but people were working 8 hour days, you know, the towns, people were living in towns, you know, they were playing sport every night of the week. You know, they had workers had control, or, you know, influence at least over the work environment. What these are meant to be the bad old days, and what the good old days are now, where there's, you know, company super profits and you know, all of these kind of issues for workers. So yeah, I mean, just to get back to your question, like it's really exciting to see you know, a serious challenge and one that's, you know, kind of involved industrial action, and one that looks like, you know, I'm hopeful that they will get, you know, a good enterprise agreement. Yeah, and I guess, you know, that the aim for me in writing the book was to make something accessible, you know, like PhDs are read by very few people generally, you know, and so I turned it into a book. I really also wanted to make sure it was not one of those academic books that cost $200 and, you know, only end up in libraries, but it's an accessible book, and you know, a bunch of people have been reading it, and excitingly, the Electrical Trades Union actually bought heaps of copies of the book, and at the their state conference on earlier, was it this week or last week? Anyway, recently they gave a copy to every delegate at the conference. So yeah, like hopefully, you know, there'll be a you know, new people coming through that are kind of reading about that history from you know, from a left-wing point of view, from a point of view of actually, you know, supporting unionism, and in particular middle class struggle unionism as the way forward. So, you know, I mean, it's not all kind of you know, rosy and up and away. Like there's huge challenges, you know, and when you think about the power of the mining industry in Australia, you know, particularly in Western Australia, it's huge, you know, and so it's not going to be easy, but there seems to be, you know, a determination there, and hopefully this will have you know, some kind of flow on effects.
And I guess, yeah, it kind of really shows the importance of documenting workers' history and activism. And, you know, it's important and great for us to kind of share stories, whether they be with our other unionists at work or around a campfire or at a conference. And all of those things are important ways to kind of share the stories of organizing and things. But nothing beats being able to have something, like you said, in an accessible format that workers can learn from as well. Because if you don't have that kind of written down and ways in which we can learn from our history, then we'll just get stuck in a cycle of being told something different from the people who control most of the narrative of these things. Like you said about people romanticizing periods that were actually pretty difficult for workers. And I guess, just we're hearing even from BHP, the current strike, they're talking about how much this is going to disrupt, investor interest in the region, and it's going to disrupt profits and things like that. I mean, I guess on the one hand, it shows that the strike, industrial action, is effective when the company is speaking like that, and how much industrial action can play a positive role. I feel like it also misses the point of, that's not what the workers' responsibility is, of how many more, billions of dollars that BHP are making. I think, they're missing the point of what the workers are striking for and what their kind of demands are really at.
That's right, and it's funny. I did an interview for Australia's Mining Monthly, which I was surprised to hear from them, but I sort of made the point that there's not a discussion about really about the workers' conditions. It's like there's, and I mean you probably haven't seen that. You don't probably see the West Australian as much as I do, James, but like with the first strike, like in the lead up to it and after it, it was like every day, like front pages and like pages and pages of the newspaper, like the darkest day for industrial relations, in Western Australia. And yeah, they'll basically pack up, like Basil Zemplis, the Liberal Party leader here, basically said the mining companies were gonna pack up and go elsewhere, as if it's like a shop or a t-shirt factory or something. You can just kind of relocate. I mean the absolute hyperbole, is incredible. And then of course after the industrial action, they're sort of trying to play down how much damage, economic damage it caused, because BHP did get people in to undermine the strike. We don't hear from the workers, and we don't really hear much, very much at all, about their conditions. I guess it's it's not a surprise to those of us kind of on the left that this is what the media landscape kind of looks like, and capitalism more broadly, that the voices that you hear are usually companies and kind of experts, not the voices of workers themselves, who must be feeling pretty strongly about it, to have voted so strongly for industrial action, to have done it despite all of the kind of pressure, the immense pressure that they've faced, not to do it, and to be pursuing that campaign.
And that's all we have time for on Stick Together this week. Stick Together is produced here at 3CR Community Radio and is distributed nationally through the Community Radio Network. Thanks again to the Community Broadcasting Foundation for supporting community broadcasting and keeping workers' voices on the air. Thanks again to Alexis for the interview and discussion today. If you've got a workplace story, industrial dispute, union campaign, or social justice issue that you'd like us to touch on in our show, get together with the team at sticktogether3cr@gmail.com. You can find all previous episodes and our podcast on the 3CR website or wherever you normally listen to podcasts. I'm James. Thanks for listening. And remember, wherever you are, whatever you do, there's a union for you. And to finish the show, we're going to hear a track, Old Man, by OK Otter. Thanks for joining us on the show.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.